Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about near-death experiences and speaking to Jimo Borjigin. She is a researcher who managed to study the brains of people as they died and found there was a correlation between what people call near-death experiences and what was happening in the brain. Fascinating stuff. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or tweet us, we're @newstalkscience. First, though, it's time to look back through the week's science news, and joining me is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, and everyone's favourite TV science guy, except for possibly me, Phil Smith. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with viruses, Ruth.
That's to do with viruses, and more specifically how viruses might kick off or act as a switch for a disease that might be hidden inside your body. And really it's to do with the mitochondria inside our cells. And anyone that remembers their school biology will have learned that mitochondria are the powerhouse or the power plant of the cell, creating energy. But as well as doing that, they actually have their own genetic material inside them. So they are responsible for making about 13 of their own genes, and they have a specific enzyme to help them do that called polymerase gamma. Now, polymerase gamma, or Pol-G, is an enzyme that's associated with lots of different mitochondrial diseases. There's a whole suite of Pol-G diseases, and most of them affect parts of the body that need a lot of energy, as you might anticipate. Right. But they range in severity in a huge way. They also range in the time that they might onset in terms of the course of life. So that's been kind of a bit of a conundrum for scientists over many, many years.
That someone might have an inherited genetic disease, but for some, it happens early, and how it happens, it's quite variable.
It's very, very variable. And of course, you've got lots of different types of mutations. There's about 200 different mutations that have been mapped to this gene as well. And this is about one particular variant or one mutation. And it was scientists in the University of Helsinki that decided to look at this mutation. And it was published in Nature this week. And what they found was, using lots of different kinds of models, that essentially the syndrome associated with this disease kicked off because of a viral infection and the response of individuals with this variant to a viral infection. And what they found was that when this variant was present, the initial immune response to the virus was quite dampened down and in a way unsatisfactory. But then that was followed up later by an excessive inflammatory response, which particularly targeted the brain and the liver, which is where we see this condition manifesting when it happens. So this could be, and the type of symptoms that one might get with this disease could be sort of neurological symptoms, seizures, lack of coordination, balance, inability to speak. But you might see it happening sort of in the teenage years with kind of severe epilepsy type symptoms. Or it could be much, much later in life with sort of Parkinson's type symptoms. But they found that this viral infection seemed to be like a trigger or a switch to kick off the manifestation of the disease.
So this is an autoimmune response, right? It's not the virus that technically does the damage, but the virus sort of knocks down the first domino, so to speak.
Exactly. It's like a hidden switch inside the person, and suddenly that switch is tripped by the virus.
Is this unusual for neurological conditions? We were talking before last year about MS and you know, this virus being very highly correlated with people who develop MS. Is it possible that there is a mechanism here for a lot of neurological conditions that we hadn't really considered?
Yeah, I mean, I think more and more we're seeing infection, you know, whether that's Helicobacter or viruses associated with a condition. So you have someone who is sort of appearing healthy, but when you have these underlying mutations or underlying, I suppose, predispositions to certain conditions, that the sort of assault of a particular infection on top of what's already there could be a trigger point, which explains why we see such wide variation. And that's very interesting, because if we can understand those trigger points more effectively, we can potentially think about how to avoid those triggers, you know, because in a way, for a lot of these conditions, you know, there isn't really a cure for many of these conditions, you know, so even in terms of doing screening, why would you screen when there's very little that you can do? Whereas, you know, if you can actually create maybe quite simple interventions to help, you know, certainly set back the onset of these conditions, that would be really helpful. And of course, we might understand them better when we really understand what's happening here.
This particular virus, is it a virus that is commonly known, or is it a virus that is associated with other conditions as far as we know?
No, not that we know now, but certainly they're going to do further research.
I'm sure they are. And looking at what a vaccine for this particular virus might do, It could be very interesting,
very
I suppose.
Interesting. Yeah.
Our second story is about Utzi the Iceman, who pops up every couple of years. Yeah. Fascinating guy.
This is kind of a blast from the past in every sense of them. Not only because I remember...
An ice baby blast
from the background. I first remember hearing about Utzi in a documentary watched in primary school.
All right.
But this is like 30 odd years ago. And like you said, it keeps popping up every again. But it's also something that's revisited every now and again, which is interesting. So for those of you who don't know, Utzi was the mummy known, found in the on the border between Austria and Italy. A 5,300-year-old Iceman, had brown eyes, brown hair, blood type O, lactose intolerant, had modern-day relatives in Corsica and Sardinia. And you might ask, well, how do we know that? Well, in 2012, they looked to try and map his genome. And the idea was that to see, you know, what was there, what was coming back. Even in finding out that he was lactose intolerant was very interesting because it informed us that at that time they were keeping cows and they were looking to see what was society like at that time.
And just to point out, not to interrupt, but this is, you know, to find the specimen like Utzi, which is because it was in ice, was so well preserved that it's an extraordinary treasure trove for researchers, which is why he's become so famous.
Absolutely, and why it's been studied so much as well. The age that we're looking at is the Copper Age, which gives you an idea of how far back we're looking. Yeah. Like this is a long, long time ago. So 5,300 years ago. And we're looking at kind of see like where he came from, where he went. So they've gone back to look at the genome again. And there was a few things that they felt were gaps in what they had looked at before. So Johannes Krauss from the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig in Germany felt that the mummy, as he's also been called, the Iceman, was an outlier in this. They put together a new genetic instruction to look at the Iceman because they felt that the old genome was heavily contaminated with modern people's DNA and as part of the study that they did in genomics back in 2012. And this actually...
You mean with the researchers back in 2012 got their grubby mitts on it and ruined the science?
Kind of, but also in terms of, if I think back to the primary school day when I was watching the video, my teacher, Mr. Lynch, described, he was like, the way they're extracting Utzi from the his icy grave, as it would be called up in the glazier, wasn't the best practice because they were hacking away at things. Right. They weren't wearing PPE that we're so used to now. So they feel that this was, so now what they're doing is looking in more depth. And what they've seen is that the skin colour changes that people expected to happen in Europe because Europeans migrated from Africa happened far later than we expected. That in white skin people is a much newer development than was previously expected. So people that lived in Europe between 4,000 years ago and 8,000 years ago were as dark as the people in Africa, which makes sense, as we said, they came from where we came from. But also we imagine that light skin people evolved much later than we thought in human history. So it's changed the perspective by us going back and revisiting previous data and taking a closer look.
Okay, so essentially we were black much more recently than we thought.
Yes, exactly.
This theory. Okay, very interesting. Our third piece, Ruth, is about touch.
Touch and the benefit of touch, which has been kind of studied a lot, but you could say in a fairly fragmented way. So this is an effort to bring together many, many studies that have been done on touch and the impact that it has on people. So it's a big meta-analysis that's brought together over 200 studies that have looked at the impact of touch involving nearly 13,000 people. So Now you can imagine these studies vary hugely. So some of it will have been the benefit of someone having a massage for an hour, while another study might have looked at the benefit of a hug. I mean, you're looking at people of all different ages and you're looking at people who are well and people that are sick. But the researchers do have big numbers here. So they have been able to find consistent patterns in that data. And they have found, which may not surprise people, that there is a real mental and physical benefit to human touch for another human. And what they found was the consistent messages that came out was that touch reduced cortisol levels in people. When it came to newborns, it helped them to put on weight and to thrive. It reduced pain, the sensation of pain, and it also helped with feelings of depression and anxiety. So across all the studies, despite the variation and the many, many variables they had to take into account, they found these consistent patterns.
Which, as you say, isn't hugely surprising. Is it clinically useful? Is it useful in a medical way, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the researchers are certainly saying that it is. And in fact, there was kind of interesting things that came out of it. I mean, some of those positive impacts, it didn't matter if the touch was coming from somebody familiar or from a healthcare professional. So that's interesting. You know, you could potentially administer it in a healthcare setting to get the benefit. The other thing, and this is slightly depressing, was it didn't matter whether the touch was coming from a human or another object. And the kind of objects that people have studied are things like, are things like weighted blankets. So again, you might have seen these on the internet. You
know, slankets?
No, they're not a slanket. They're like a very heavy blanket. Sometimes they actually have little weights in them. And for some people who suffer from anxiety, they find this very helpful because it's sort of this gentle pressing weight pressing down, and people will report that it helps them to feel grounded and less anxious.
I love the idea of that.
Yeah, and they also looked actually at robots and companion robots, and people, there have been some studies looking at that touch from robots as well. And all of this touch was beneficial. Now they did find it was kind of marginally better if you were getting touched on your head versus other parts of your body. So the head and the face had a particularly good benefit. Mm. And they also found that the mental health benefits were particularly emphasized in people who were unwell.
Right. I think probably some cultural work might need to be done before we start allowing doctors and nurses to touch us on our face unsolicited.
Well, all of this is consensual touch. None of it is unsolicited.
But even still, I think even still, you know, for a doctor to say, now I'm going to inject this needle, just let me rub your face or hold you. You know, there's boundaries there.
Absolutely. And the researchers did reference that, like there would be cultural norms here, and that they didn't have enough data to look into that kind of thing. But it does seem that, you know, that our skin has these receptors. You know, they are associated with how we manage particularly hormone balances and things in our bodies. So there does seem to be something here. And when you think about now, like the emphasis on talk therapy and other therapies that are beneficial, it certainly seems that touch therapy should go into the bucket of kind of instruments to help people feel better.
Speaking of buckets, I did see a story during the week of basketball players being either hugged or tapped in the shoulder and performing better. Mm.
That's right. That was posted this week, and this was a research from the University of Basel. And what they looked at 60 games, and they looked at free throws. So when a player gets fouled, when they're going up to take a shot, they get to take two baskets unimpeded from a line in front of the basket. And they found 835 incidents of people having to take those free throws. And they looked back to see, was there a correlation between the person, it was women's basketball, being tapped on the shoulder or her hand being squeezed by one of her four teammates. And they found there was a positive correlation in the player making the second shot if they had had that physical contact from their teammates. And of course, they're saying that's the most acutely stressful time. You've missed the first free throw and you've got to get the second one. So all teams should be doing that.
Well, I mean, you look at netball and like the amount of hugging that happens, and volleyball, the amount of hugging that happens after. They should just never miss a shot, the amount of hugging there's in those sports. Finally, Phil, fear.
Fear and anger leads to all of those things that we... how do you relieve anger? If I was to say you look really angry, is anything that comes to mind that you'd want to do to get rid of it?
Maybe someone could tell you to calm down.
Oh, that helps you? Okay, Ruth, geez. Doesn't necessarily help me, but researchers in Japan have been looking at this, particularly about actually something in relation to what they called hakidashisara, which I'll explain in
a
moment. Of course, you know it well. Very good. But since time immemorial, humans have tried to devise anger management techniques. Like ancient Rome, you would have had philosophers who would have said that my anger is likely to do me more harm than you're wrong. So the more that you hold on to something, the more it physically manifests. And it speaks to what Ruth was talking about earlier on, how the mental side of things is particularly impacting upon what we actually physically feel. So a study in Japan has found that writing down your reaction to a negative incident on a piece of paper and then shredding it or scrunching it into a ball and throwing it into the bin gets rid of anger. Now, you might have seen things before, like when people are like, I've had a bad breakup, I'm going to burn all this stuff. You know that scene in Friends as well. One jumps to mind as well. So this isn't like the other story, not necessarily new. But what the researchers were expressly surprised by was actually the amount of anger that this reduced. So researchers believe that shredding results may be related to a phenomenon called the backward magical contagion. Now, as a scientist, when the word magical is introduced to anything, I think snake oil all the time. But it is the belief that actions taken on an object associated with a person can affect the physicals themselves. So they took 50 student participants and they were asked to write brief opinions of an important social problem, whether it was like smoking in public, whether there should be outlawed problems, where they thought about these things that would actually naturally anger. And when they wrote them down and throw them away, the level of anger reduced by about 75 to 80% on average of these 50 students, which is quite a significant amount as opposed to using other techniques that they talked about. So they felt that angers who discarded the paper or shredded it returned to their initial state, while those who retained a hard copy of the paper experienced only increased, received a small decrease in their overall anger.
So I talked about many times the idea that you can just say to someone, "Oh, you're going to feel something now, and then I'm going to do something, and then you're not going to feel it anymore." That's something that I don't hold a lot of sway, but I'm going to say to you listeners, right? This week, if you feel angry about something, write it down. Write down what you're angry about, and then scrunch it up into a ball and throw it in the bin. And actually, tell us, does that help at all? Just, this is our own experiment on the program. Not very scientific, I totally grant you. But I want to hear you. You can email us science@newstalk.com or you can tweet us. We're @newstalkscience. Thanks to Phil Smith and Dr. Ruth Freeman. Coming up, a really fascinating look at near-death experiences and what is happening in the brain as someone passes away. Stay with us. Now, many of us would be familiar with the idea of near-death experiences. You may have heard stories or seen depictions in TV or movies, and generally you see a dying person experiencing sort of unusual phenomena, floating out of their body, lights, and all that sort of stuff. What you may not know is that these aren't just old wives' tales, but often a widely reported phenomenon, and one that real scientists have deemed worthy of serious research. My next guest is one such scientist. Her name is Jimmo Borjigin. She is Associate Professor of Molecular and Integrative Physiology at the University of Michigan. She joins me now. Jimmo, this is such a fascinating area of research, and there's so much that we don't really know about death. Can you give us the definition of death from a medical point of view?
Wow. Okay. Well, death, especially if you suffer cardiac arrest, it typically occurs in several phases. First of all, you feel fainting. Okay. And then you drop to the ground and you lose consciousness. That's a first step. Everybody is going to say, oh, somebody's suffering cardiac arrest. They will be collapsed to the ground and lose consciousness. That's stage one. So if this is simple syncope, you could simultaneously actually spontaneously recover from this without any subsequent care. But if this is true cardiac arrest, then heart may stop pumping blood. So at this stage, you will be called clinically dead. Okay, clinically dead, basically, your heart is not pumping the blood the way it should.
Yeah. But so after how long of the heart not pumping do we say, okay, clinically dead?
Clinical dead just means just the moment the heart stopped pumping blood.
Oh.
Okay, so they can't sense your pulse. But it doesn't mean heart has stopped beating electrically, okay? So heart may have so-called pulseless electrical activity for minutes until it finally flatlines. So this the patient we studied is actually probably going through both the moment their heart stopped pumping blood as well as the pulseless electrical activity. But anyway, so at the point of clinical death, you're not totally dead yet, because you would still have heart activity still may be there and the brain activity is still there. So somebody would be truly dead if you have both EEG activity, EKG activity, that means the activity of the heart and activity of the brain both flatlined. Then I think any physician would be confident to call somebody dead at that moment.
And the way we measure brain activity is via EEG, those caps with sensors on the brain, on the scalp?
Yes, electroencephalogram or EEG.
Yeah. And so I suppose the best way to talk about your work and what is really intriguing neuroscientists and physiologists at the moment is to talk about patient one. So tell me about patient one, how you ended up meeting them and what exactly happened.
Yes. I mean, since cardiac arrest normally happens at home, for most patients, they happen at home. There's no way you could predict when that's going to happen for anybody who is not already in the hospital. So we then thought there are critically ill patients in the hospital, in the ICU situation, then they're typically on life support. And if their prognosis is very poor, the family members may get together with the physicians to decide it's time to let them go. So right. letting them go actually involves removal of life support, including the ventilators, which is a breathing tube. Mm. So I think, so, and then patients typically die within 30 minutes of that. And so those are the patients we studied because the data, meaning the heart data as well as the brain data, are both collected and stored for research purposes later on.
Mm. So when patient one died, what did you find that was surprising?
Yes. Okay. So first of all, for the first 2 minutes, the patient one's heart rate, instead of decreasing, actually started slowly increasing for as long as about 150 seconds. So that's surprising. Usually hypoxia reduces your heart rate very fast. But the patient one, as well as patient three in our studies, actually had gradual increase of heart rate, suggesting the brain is functioning during that period. It's trying to perhaps save the heart, you know, making heart pump faster because the oxygen is not coming when the heart stopped pumping. When oxygen, I mean, the ventilator is removed, oxygen is not coming. And the only way really brain knows how to deal with that situation is to increase the heart rate, say, pump faster so that it brings you back the oxygen.
But that wouldn't necessarily need to be a neurological response, right? It could be an autonomous response, you know, that didn't come from the brain. Isn't that right?
No, but during that time, brain shows really high level of high frequency electrical activity called a gamma activity.
Right.
We showed that gamma, not only the power level of activity increases, but also it's functionally connected between different parts of the brain. So for instance, the front of the brain may be connected with the back of the brain. So there's a functional communication going on in a non-random manner,
yes.
which is suggesting really brain is highly functionally activated through by this hypoxia process.
So what you're saying is that the brain patterns that you recorded in the brain after clinical death were not just random firing of neurons, but it seemed like there was an ordered sort of protocol, or there was something going on in the brain that didn't just seem like just a random pattern because everything was shutting down.
That's a very good way to explaining the whole thing. But I wanted to correct one thing. Is that this patient, we don't really know exactly at what point the patient could be called clinically dead,
right.
because we just removed the ventilator. We were not monitoring the pulse.
Okay? Right,
so you
right,
don't know
okay.
when exactly pulse stopped. But after the ventilator was removed, the heart was beating faster, and then the brain was actually functioning in the higher gear, which is a very surprising finding for one, right? So that's what happens first for the patient. And then the phase two is like patient's heart rate now starts to linearly decreasing for a few seconds, about 18 seconds. And then that triggered additional brain activation. So the brain activation became more intense after that. And then maintained the heart rate at certain levels, a slower rate, but for a few, at least 2 minutes after that. And then looks like the brain couldn't hold that level of activity. And then there's suddenly there's asystole, that his heart like just stopped pumping, beating electrically for about 18 seconds. And after that, brain has another bout of activity. So it's like almost like the three-tiered activation. So and then finally, high-frequency activity become flatlined. Doesn't mean that a brain didn't have any other electrical activity. When the heart is still beating, the now brain's activity switch from high frequency to low frequency until the heart activity as well as brain activity both flatlined.
What are the significance of high and low frequency gamma? Can we unpack the puzzle of what's happening in the brain at that time? What do we normally associate that sort of activity with?
You're asking great question. I wish I could tell you all about it in just 10 minutes of time. But in general, high frequency activity just means brain is communicating with the different parts of the brain very in a highway, like super fast speed.
Right.
Okay, imagine this is like critical situation. So I think it makes sense the brain is utilizing this faster communication tool to convey information.
Hmm.
Okay. So, this is an extremely energy demanding process to use high frequency activity to communicate. So, and my guess is that the energy source is depleted toward the end of the dying process, and then it now switch to lower frequency activity.
So what I would be really interested in is comparing patient one and patient three's, for example, their brain patterns and the order in which these things happen. Did patient one's brain activity and the steps that you've just described, was that mirrored in patient three, or was it very different?
It's actually, in many ways, they're very similar in terms of the parts of the brain that's activated, especially during the initial hypoxic stage before the heart rate starts to drop.
Yeah.
But the difference between patient one and patient three is patient one is very young. She was 24 when she died.
Mm.
Patient three is 77 years old. And the patient one never had a defect in the brain activity. So her brain was never known to have any kind of disorders.
Right.
But patient three had a major brain surgery to remove the aneurysms in her brain because she had a major brain bleeding. So actually, the surgeons had to remove a chunk of her brain tissues from
right. So you can't really compare those two brains at all. What you want in a way is twins, but of course the implications of that would be awful. So let's talk a little bit about near death experiences, because during these flashes across the cortex, so the motor cortex, for example, the visual cortex, did you see any activity in those areas of the brain that we associate with movement or light or vision that would correlate to the standard auto description of what people talk about when they talk about near death experiences? And are they as common as you know, legend would have it?
Yes. Okay. So one very common report is seeing lights.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're a neuroscientist, first thing you're going to look for activity will be the visual cortex, which is the back part of your brain. Okay. And sure enough, that part of the brain is super hot, highly activated during this entire process. So I think I would not be surprised that some kind of internal vision was stimulated during this process. That's for light. Okay. So in addition, the part of the brain responsible for motion sensing, that is if it's a defective, you might get out-of-body experience. This is actually part of the brain. It's within so-called posterior hot zone of the brain. When that part is stimulated, then even in the normal human subject, you would have sensation floating in the air.
This is right. I heard about this, that you can actually get a little probe, and if you electrically stimulate a certain part of the brain, you can induce in healthy people a sense of out-of-body experience. And you're saying that part of the brain actually lights up during that period?
Yes.
Wow.
It's highly activated in both left side and the right side. So that's very interesting in both patients. So I think that's suggestive of, so we might have identified a neural correlates of out-of-body experience.
Wow.
I mean, I have to say is we might, because these two patients didn't survive. So we couldn't really ask them whether they really had out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that I wish we could continue to analyze in the future. So we have a vision, we have an out-of-body experience. And the other feature that many survivors would tell us is that they have newly acquired sense of somehow their life, the near-death experience somehow changed their life. Okay, so they feel like they have empathy that they didn't have before. So that indicates that they're able to stand in somebody else's shoes to see things from their point of view, understand somebody else's mind. This is almost like a theory of mind.
Right.
So that's been shown to be responsible by the right side of your so-called temporal parietal junction, right TPJ. So the right TPJ parts of the brain, so that's highly activated in the patient. So I think we think that these two patients, if they survived, they might have described a similar phenomenon, that it's a newly acquired sense of empathy.
That sounds really interesting, but can I ask you a question? do you see activity everywhere in the brain or not at all? I mean, are these areas that you talk about that we associate with near-death experiences that are flaring up in this dying process that you've recorded as a patient dies, do you also see flaring up in lots of places that have nothing to do with near-death experiences?
No, actually, that's really the interesting thing, is that distinguish the what human dying process compared to animals' dying process. In animal studies we did for the past 10 years to show entire brain lights up. And so entire brain is in this brainstorming phase, and happens in 100% of animals dying.
So are you saying that a rat's brain as it dies looks very different to a human's brain as it dies? Why would that be? They're both mammals. I don't understand. Why would that be?
We humans have a huge cerebral cortex, and the function is very finely defined compared to rats. So, but the idea that a brain is activated immediately following the hypoxia is true, conserved from rats to humans.
Right. So what sort of implications does this research have, I guess, on near-death experiences? Because people do report having these things, you know, when they're close to death and then come back. And what does it say to us about where we draw the line for death? I mean, presumably with these patients who have their heart stopped, you know, the EEGs not showing anything, presumably, you know, the sense of them being alive, even if it's a small, you know, a firing of neurons here or there, we wouldn't really call that person living, would we?
Right. That's such a good question. So we don't have the data yet. We don't have any evidence from people who had a cardiac arrest and monitored. So we have the data from the heart, from the brain, and then they survived and had NDE. So we don't have data from any human individuals with that detailed data evidence. So I predict if we did, then we're going to be able to correlate the electrical activity patterns of during the dying phases with their subjective experience of NDE. Mm. But until we have the data, we can't really say.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's it. But I think one thing that it tells us is that the NDE is likely occurring before the EEG or EKG flatlined. So it happens before the final death moment or dead moment. Yeah, that's one thing that we could learn from this. And also the other thing is that these NDEs can be studied using the conventional neuroscientific tools that we employed in the study. So I think that's another thing, that is a subjective experience can be actually probed and studied using neurological methods.
And measuring against reported experience, which is you know, obviously hugely exciting. Can you just finally tell me, does this leave the window open for us to bring people back from death? Wasn't there a study in Yale where they did something with, was it pigs?
I'm so glad you brought up that. What the scientists did is they went to pig slaughterhouse and got several decapitated heads that were sitting on their benchtop for more than 4 hours at the room temperature. So they brought it back to their labs, and then they gave the brain a reperfused brain, so add lots of chemicals, and they were able to see the neurons showing activities hours after they were already severed from the heart, presumably not getting any oxygen. And even during that situation, the neurons can be still firing, can show normal activities, show normal metabolic activities and so forth. So I think that's a really stunning discovery that just shows how little we know. But this is not just in animals. And we know there were a few cases of humans that after the cardiac arrest, especially in the cold climate, I think two cases that both happened in Europe, where these cardiac arrest patients in the hypoxic state were resuscitated 7 to 8 hours later. But this is mostly restricted to events happening during the very cold temperature.
Yeah.
So I think that shows that a cold temperature is beneficial to the survival of the cardiac arrest patients, which is why we have hypothermia therapy for cardiac arrest patients, but also shows that we really have very little clue as to exactly what happened to the brain during the cardiac arrest. If you think about the current focus in resuscitation, so we focus so much on the heart but very little attention on the brain. So if we know the brain, there's something happened, interesting happened in the brain during cardiac arrest, we ought to study that process. And I think that currently there's not enough interest in the field to pay more attention to the brain. So I think that really, if anything, should arouse attention or interest among cardiologists or emergency medicine physicians or scientists who cares about the dying process, who understands how dying exactly takes place in animals and humans. So we understand the mechanism, so we can then come up with a therapy, right, to delay the death and to perhaps even reverse the process we thought was already terminal.
Jimmo Borgigin from the University of Michigan, thank you so much. Very interesting work.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Really interesting stuff. If you have had or know someone who has had a near-death experience, we would love to hear that story. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or tweet us. We're at @NewstalkScience. We haven't had a chance yet because we were there was a bit of a fiddly stuff last week, so we didn't put out our normal podcast. And so we didn't have a chance to speak about Annie Jacobson's interview 2 weeks ago on the podcast. And I don't know if you missed that one. By God, make sure you listen to it. Absolutely incredible interview. A really well-respected journalist and expert in defense affairs in the United States. Extremely well-researched book that looked at a hypothetical scenario of what would happen if, for example, a country launched a nuclear missile at the United States. What would happen if that happened? And what unravels in this book is really extraordinary. The series of protocols that happen that ultimately, if all protocols are followed, will almost, as a necessity, precipitate the end of the world, which is kind of insane, right? You may have heard of mutually assured destruction, Dr. Strange, of this idea. This is very much baked into the protocols of the defense forces in the United States of America, as Annie Jacobson told it. Gary said, and yet we're fixated on CO2, despite the fact that civilization can be wiped out in 72 minutes. Well, I mean, like, you can worry about both, can't you?
I feel like Gary might have learned the wrong lesson from that.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, why bother worrying about anything? It'll be grand. We're all going to die anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, while it is very scary, like, you do hope that common sense will somehow prevail, or there will be people who we talked about this last week, who may say, I am not going to launch that thing. I'm just going to just sit and I'm not going to do that. But if protocols follow, that's what's going to happen. I think we can worry about that and kind of think this isn't a good thing, and at the same time try and save the planet for future generations. I think those things are both doable. I have plenty of worry to go around. Moira Devine says, absolutely terrifying. The world feels very wobbly, and this morning's discussion reared the reality of nuclear annihilation would almost make one throw their hands up in despair. Man seems determined to wipe out humankind. Thanks for making my Sunday. Cool glasses emoji. It's funny, isn't it? I get the biggest thrill from the scariest stuff. Do you? Like, I'm fascinated by the stuff that is the most life-threatening. And I love talking about it. I'm very morbid in that way, but I just find it the whole idea of life itself and the end of life, those two things are fascinating to me endlessly.
Oh yeah, they're definitely fascinating. Like, I find sometimes as I get a bit older, the grimmer stories in news or even on our show, I'm a bit less, like, I have to kind of push myself to put them on the show because I'm like, come on, do we really need this? But I mean, I think the nuclear war thing, it sounds bizarre, but you can almost detach yourself from the reality of it because you kind of have no control over whatsoever, and it would happen so quickly, and it seems so kind of TV movie thing.
I'm not gonna
waste my time worrying about it. Like, it's just, it happens or it doesn't happen. It's like getting on a plane. It crashes or it doesn't crash. Don't worry about it.
No, it's a perfect analogy because I felt like I wanted to eat popcorn listening to Annie talk. I was like this. I'm imagining the whole end of the world through nuclear destruction and, you know, and which is obviously horrific in some way. But at the same time, as you say, you can sort of remove yourself from it and go, this is pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's just like, what? Your brain is a funny thing.
It's got that intrigue and it's got some sort of detachment, whereas you don't really have that intrigue when you talk about, like, climate change or, like, various wars that are going on at the moment. That's just like, oh, God.
Like, what? Like, we talked about this before, about, you know, is it just that we have the American media machine has just romanticized war and machines of war in such a way that we can't but think of like, you know, these engines of death without going, oh, that's pretty cool, isn't it? Look at that one. Like, you know, like when you see like a gun, you ever see a gun? Like, I don't know how it's happened, but in my brain, I see a gun and go, oh, that's pretty cool. Though, the way, like they've designed it in a way that makes it sort of attractive. And at the same time, I'm, you know, I'm a pacifist. I'm horrified when I read stories of violence in the news, like any normal person. But there's this sort of thing about weaponry. I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened in my childhood. But like, and you play video games like Call of Duty, and they have all these skins on these weapons, these various machine guns that you can shoot, you know, people on the internet with. Like, it's horrifying. It's all horrifying. It's just this weird macabre.
You know, I don't know if
it's sublime. It's the awe at the beauty of horror.
I don't know if it's learned. Like, I don't know if we can blame. This is obviously controversial. I'm not a scientist, so I can say this. So I don't have to back it up. But it might be like fundamental, because you mentioned the, you know, you as a child and your obsession with guns and you're a pacifist now. I too am an ardent pacifist. I've literally never been in a fight in my adult life. Never thrown a punch, gotten a punch.
I've gotten a punch.
The whole thing. That does not surprise me.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew, and also true. Also
but my distaste for it as an adult is at odds with, like, as a kid, I was definitely fascinated with it. And recently I had a funny experience. My nephew, my godson, has gotten really into the old Nintendo 64 game GoldenEye, a classic, which I was
great game.
Outrageously, like, stupidly good at, because I just spent all my time playing it. And I was saying to him, I was like, oh yeah, I used to go through this level without wasting a bullet. I'd like knock everyone off one shot to the head the whole way through. And I could see Mona, who didn't know me when I was that young, my partner, looking at me going, who are you? Killing all these people. They're like, oh, it's great. You get them from here. You shoot them from here.
Do you know what you want to play? Is Miami Hotline.
That sounds...
Miami
sorry.
Hot. if you're a gamer, from, you know, if you gamed in the 80s, 90s, and... It's adult. It's very adult. It's not for children at all, right? But if you are someone who's nostalgic for gameplay of the 1980s and just like savagely impossible video games, Miami Hotline. You can play it on PC or Mac with Steam. It is so good and so beautifully designed. It's amazing.
And now we know why you were so busy this week.
I tell you, like, no joke, you can play this game, right? And you go, you press four buttons, you're dead. Four buttons, you're dead. Four buttons. You just have to press, like, we're talking microseconds in between to get out, dodge the bullet, and then move. I know I'm sounding really like a real nerd here, but it is, it's everything about Miami Hotline. Highly recommend. B Green said, dude, I'm heading out to buy that book, Epic Episode. It really was. And actually, I was saying myself, it is a nonfiction, hypothetical, but I don't read a lot of nonfiction because I do this at work quite a lot. So when I want to relax, I read fiction or I watch a movie or sometimes play video games. This is something I have devoured. It's fascinating and just it reads as really well researched.
Yeah, I have it at home on the top of the pile for the next book to go to.
Tony in Galway says, Tom Clancy's book, The Sum of All Fears, dealt with this. Some terrorists get their hands on a lost nuclear missile and set it off in the US. They blame Russia and up their defense level in response. Russia denies it was them, but up their level, and then so on and so on. Eventually, Jack Ryan says today, scariest book I've ever read. Probably quite well researched as well, knowing Tom Clancy. Any plans for nuclear war that are more than 2 years old will have to be completely rewritten after the drone war in the Ukraine. I think nuclear war is slightly different to localized drone war, no matter how significant those drones are and how horrific the death loss is there. I think nuclear war is a totally different kettle of fish, personally. And another person says, morning from Washington, listening to the interview with Annie Jacobson. What an amazing interview. Like, only 20 minutes. I live only 20 minutes from the Pentagon. We'll check the book out now. Happy Easter and hello to all my family in Ireland. Well, hello to them too. And don't worry about living close to the Pentagon. I don't think you're in grave threat right now. That's it from us on this week's program. If you have near-death experience stories, please do send them in, anonymize them or whatever you want to do. Ask us not to call out the name. We won't. But we would love to hear those, because you gotta imagine they happen one in a million, but actually maybe they're more common than you think. You can email us science@newstalk.com or send us a voice note on WhatsApp 087-1400-106. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, the rest of the team. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday, which is also brain related as it happens. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.